it's John Finnemore's souvenir programme.
Hi, I'm Lisa.
Hi.
What's your name?
People call me
Kay. Kay? Isn't that a girl's name?
Not Kay. Kay, just the letter K.
Oh, right. What's it short for?
My name.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, what is it? Oh, dear, is it Kevin? Or, Carl?
No, it's worse than that.
Keith? Kenneth?
It's Kermit.
Oh. Right. Kermit is...
Yes and no and yes and no and yes and no.
Sorry?
Yes, like the frog. No, not after the frog. Yes, it's a real name. No, my parents didn't hate me. Yes, I did get teased at school. No, it's not easy being green.
Well, there's no need to be like that.
But what, you weren't going to ask any of those things?
No, I wasn't.
Yes, you were. Everyone does.
Not me, Kermit. I'm different. I know how you feel.
Oh, I'm sure you do. With a name like Lisa, I'm sure you feel my pain.
Lisa Simpson.
Oh, my God.
Yes, like Lisa Simpson. No, not after Lisa Simpson. Yes, at least it's memorable. No, I don't have a brother. Yes, I did get teased at school. No, I can't do the voice.
My God. I've never met anyone who understood. I know this is sudden, but will you marry me?
Maybe. What's your surname?
Minnelli.
Absolutely not.
Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grip of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of Nazi rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight in the air. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields. And is this right? We shall fight them. Fight. The word seems suddenly peculiar. Fight. I'm going to fight you now because I'm a fighter. Let's see who fights better and who is the best at fighting in a fight. Fight. Yes, it sounds all right now. Fight. Yes. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Messenger.
My lord?
Messenger, what news?
It's no news, my lord. That's not how messengers work.
What do you mean?
I'm your messenger, my lord. You can't just call me out of my messenger cubbyhole and expect me to have news. You either have to send me off with a message or wait for someone else's messenger to arrive. The only news I have is news of the messenger cubbyhole.
Aha! What news of the messenger cubbyhole?
Messenger cubbyhole recently vacated by messenger. Cubbyhole stands empty. Sources close to cubbyhole question point of messenger being summoned.
Very good. Now, take this message across the plains to the Cloven Viscount. Count! For too long our lands have been at war. I grow weary of the conflict and offer my hand in peace. What say you, you?
Got it. Kiss, kiss, kiss.
No, too soon. Just a smiley face.
I go. Oh, excuse me.
Excuse me. I arrive.
Who are you?
I am the messenger of the Cloven Viscount from across the plains. He says he grows tired of this war of attrition. Surrender immediately, vile worm, or prepare to be ground into the dust.
What?
I know, exciting, isn't it?
Tell him I yield to no man, especially a horror bag like him. He should prepare for bloody warfare, in which he will be the one being ground into the dust, and I will be the one grinding him with my heel, which I wouldn't even have one of if I was a worm like what he thinks, so that shows all he knows.
Righto, I go!
Excuse me. I arrive!
Oh, you're back.
Yes, with a message from across the plains. The Cloven Viscount thanks you for your incredibly prompt reply. He says it has oft been said that a soft answer turneth away wrath, and it must be true because that's what's happened this time. He withdraws his threat of dust grinding, extends an olive branch, and says to tell you you can have some olives off of it.
Oh, well, all right. Our army's rubbish anyway. Tell him we will overlook his hasty words on this occasion and thank him for the olives, even though I don't like olives, actually. But don't tell him that it's secret. That's called diplomacy. Similarly, don't tell him the bit about our army being rubbish.
Got it. I go! Oh,
excuse me. I arrive.
Yes.
The Cloven Viscount from across the plains sends greeting curses and anti-hellos. He is incensed you should treat his olive branch with such contempt, and he says to say the olives are off the table and the worm-crushing programme is on as before.
What? But I said I wanted the olives.
I'm pretty sure you didn't.
Not to you, to my messenger. Oh, I see the smack. Messenger, speed across the plains and tell the Viscount we've got out of sync.
I go!
Excuse me. I arrive. The Viscount wishes to inform you you've got out of sync.
Yes, tell him I know.
I go.
Excuse me. I arrive. He says I know.
Oh, for God's sake.
Shall I tell him, oh, for God's sake?
No. Wait a while here with me. If I know him, he'll send my guy back to say, oh, for God's sake, and then we'll be in sync again.
I like your castle.
Thank you.
Nice crenellations.
Actually, they're dahlias.
My mistake. I think he's waiting.
I know he's waiting too.
What shall I?
Yes, all right. Tell him my silence was just me waiting to get back in sync, and my offer of peace stands as before.
I go.
Oh, excuse me. I arrive. The Viscount says his silence was just him waiting to get in sync, and his threat of war stands as before.
Oh, bloody hell!
I arrive.
Oh, you're new. Who are you?
I come from the peace-loving people of the plains.
Do you?
That I do, and I bring a message.
What is it?
Corbett, you aren't off making a mess of them planes. We just got them all nice and the way we wanted them this morning, and now it's wall-to-wall messengers back and forth turning up the planes some in our age. Can you please stop it?
Well, how can we stop it? We've got two messengers out of sync, and we can't get back in sync again.
Of course you can, sir. Nothing easier.
How?
Shoot the messenger.
Hey, no! Don't shoot the messenger. That's the one thing everyone knows about messengers. It's the motto of the Messengers Guild.
Why shoot the messenger?
Well, because then you'll only have one messenger between you and you'll never be out of sync, and the planes will be relatively undisturbed.
Oh, yes.
I thought you said you were the peace-loving people of the planes.
And so we are, as in we like the planes peaceful. We're not that fussed about messengers. I go.
Ah, he seemed nice. Well, sorry about this, messenger, but it does seem like the neatest solution.
No, but wait, you don't need to shoot me. You could just give me the evening off.
Oh, that's true. Oh, well, too late. Now all I have to do is await the return of the other messenger. Oh, knickers. Welcome to Nobody Knows, the game where your guess is as good as mine.
Nobody knows.
Let's meet the contestants. Anne, you're a sleep therapist. Tell me, why do we dream?
Nobody knows.
Richard, hi, why are you?
Very well, thank you.
I said, why are you?
Oh, sorry. Nobody knows.
And Frank, good to see you. Tell me, when will you die?
Nobody knows.
So, let's play Nobody Knows.
Nobody knows.
So, you all know the rules. Richard, what category would you like? Unknowable, subjective, or forgotten?
Unknowable, please.
All right, Richard. How many games of Scrabble in history have featured the word syringe?
Nobody knows.
Anne, your question.
I'll have forgotten, please.
Okay. In history, where was Oliver Cromwell most ticklish?
Nobody knows.
And Frank, that leads you with subjective. In the world of sport, who was best?
Donald Bradman.
Possibly, but technically...
Nobody knows.
And at the end of round one, Carol, the scores are...
Unknowable.
That's right. So, as a tiebreaker, fingers on buzzers, this one's to all of you, and it's unknowable, subjective, and forgotten. In literature, which of the Bronte sisters was best in bed?
Nobody knows.
Right, and back to the studio in five.
Thank you.
I do hope this is going to be a proper interview, Mr. Humphreys, not just a character assassination.
I think you'll find it fair.
That's what Paxman said.
The time is just coming up to 8:10. I'm joined now by Vernon Geyer, the head of a pressure group, which claims to be campaigning against prejudice. But, Mr. Geyer, when it comes down to it, isn't it true to say you and your type are nothing but vultures?
Yes, that's quite correct.
Well, you're very frank about it.
And why not? There's nothing shameful about being a vulture.
Is that so? Do you deny, then, that you and your kind feast on dead bodies?
If you mean by that inflammatory language, are the animals we consume dead, then yes. Would you prefer it if they were alive?
The question
is... You see, this is exactly the sort of double standards we're campaigning against. Take the
eagles.
We're
not talking about the
eagles. Take the eagles.
This
isn't
about the
eagles. Everyone loves the eagles.
I want to talk about...
The eagles are heroes. The eagles are on stamps and coins and shields. Now, what do you think the eagles eat?
The point...
They eat exactly the same creatures as we vultures. The only difference is they also murder them. How is that better?
Well, one thing they don't do is hang around sick animals waiting for them to die. How can you justify behaviour like that?
What, keeping a vigil? Selflessly staying with a suffering creature in its most desperate hour so that it need not die alone?
And then devouring the corpse.
Afterwards? Once they have no further need for it, and only, of course, if they die. Often they don't. And believe me, no one is more delighted than a vulture by an unexpected pull through.
Well, that's not... That's not what it says here. According to Wikipedia...
Oh, well, Wikipedia.
Vultures gorge themselves when prey is abundant and then lapse into a torpid state to digest their food.
Or, to put it another way, vultures eat when there's food around and then they have a little nap.
Vast numbers have been seen on battlefields.
Yes, well, you could say the same about stretcher bearers.
Vulture's stomach acid is exceptionally corrosive.
You see, this is now just name-calling. And in any case, do you know why it's corrosive? Because we have to deal with botulism, anthrax, cholera, all sorts of deadly diseases we remove from the food chain.
Oh, that's why, is it? Because it says here this allows them to use their reeking corrosive vomit as a defensive projectile when threatened.
When threatened! When all peaceful methods have been exhausted.
It's not a very prepossessing picture, is it? You standing there waiting for some animal to die so you can eat it with your corrosive vomit and your scaly bald head.
Oh, I'm sorry if my baldness offends you. Would you say that to James Naughty? And actually, as it happens, our baldness is a deliberate hygiene precaution. It allows us to keep our head clean when feeding.
Oh, you mean so that you don't get blood all over your feathers when you dip your head in a corpse?
All right, I've had enough. This interview is over.
Let me read you another quote. Vultures urinate straight down their legs.
Oh, well, if you're just going to descend into the gutter.
Or like the urine down your legs.
Right, I'm sorry, but you were warned.
Ah! Oh, God, it stings! It stings!
When threatened, Mr. Humphreys. Good day.
The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Is that right? What your country can do for you? Country? Country? Sorry, it's just the word's gone funny on me. Country? What country are you from? Is it a big country or a little country? My country's a nice country, especially... In the countryside. Country, country, country. Okay, it's sort of normal again now. Ask what you can do for your country.
Here we are, same again.
Oh, thanks, mate. Cheers.
Cheers.
Ooh, look. Will.
Yeah.
We're best mates, aren't we?
Of course we are.
Okay, so look, I'm going to ask you something now. Been meaning to ask you this for years and years and years and years. Years.
Gee, am I going to like it?
No, it's nothing. It's all right. It's, well, you're rich, aren't you?
I do all right.
You're rich. You're properly rich. So the thing is, well, the question is, what do you do?
You know what I do, Rob. I'm an investment manager.
Yeah, but what is that? I mean, what do you actually do?
You know, I trade in securities, commodities and futures with other brokers around the world.
Yeah, but how does that make money? You know, because, I mean, it boils down to swapsies, doesn't it? You know, like, if you and a guy in Tokyo do a swap of whatever it is, I don't know, currencies or commodities or whichever, one of you must be doing better out of it and one of you's doing worse.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah. So, one of you should get poorer. But all stockbrokers are rich. You know, even though some must be doing worse swaps, they're all rich. And I don't know how that can be possible. I mean, you know, it's like making money out of nothing.
What, like alchemy?
Yeah. What?
You know, turning base metal into gold.
Yeah, but seriously, though, I mean...
Right, it used to be taken very seriously indeed. Alchemist was a respected profession. They had laboratories, guilds. Isaac Newton wrote more about alchemy than he did about physics.
Yeah, well, why are you going on about alchemy?
I don't know. You're talking about making money from nothing, I suppose. It just reminded me of something I always wondered about alchemy. If someone actually did it, you know, found a way of turning tin into gold, what would he do with his discovery?
Make himself loads of gold?
Ah, but then he's just weakening the supply, isn't he? Gold's only valuable because it's rare. If you turn tin into gold, you're not going to make tin as valuable as gold. You're going to make gold as cheap as tin.
Yeah, I suppose, but he could patent it, couldn't he? He could sell the invention.
Yeah, maybe, but there were so many alchemists in those days. If someone actually did it, it wouldn't take long for the rest of them to work out how, and then you're in the same situation. The market's flooded with gold, the invention's worthless.
So what would you do?
Me? I don't know. The only thing I can think of is, gather all the guild of alchemists together, secretly, tell them I've cracked it, and agree to share the secret, if they swear only to make a small amount of gold each year, you know, enough to make them rich, but not enough to devalue gold.
Yeah, but if all the alchemists suddenly got rich, people would guess, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the other condition would have to be that they would all have to give up alchemy, you know, let it die away, and instead found some other profession. Something associated with the supply of gold into the market. Something that everyone would learn just to take it for granted made people rich somehow, but was way too complex for anyone who wasn't a qualified member of the guild to understand. And that way you could keep the system going, well, for generations, handing the secret down.
What sort of profession?
Who knows? I'll tell you a funny thing, though. Between 1780 and 1800, alchemy suddenly almost entirely died out. And the London Stock Exchange was founded in 1801.
So what?
Nothing. Just rambling on. Want another drink?
Yeah. Oh, but it's my round.
No, I'll get it. I made a bit of money today.
Nobody knows.
As we enter into the final round, what are the scores, Carol?
Everybody's got some points. Nobody knows how many.
Terrific. And so, fingers on the buzzers for our quickfire round. In crime, who was Jack the Ripper?
Nobody knows.
In science, how big is the universe?
Nobody knows.
In history, what was Julius Caesar's favourite colour?
Nobody knows.
In natural history, what are cows thinking about?
Nobody knows.
In religion?
Nobody knows.
Well interrupted, Anne. You're quite right, nobody knows. In maths? Oh, and at the end of that fast and furious round, Carol, the scores are...
veiled in mystery.
As every week. And so, as every week, it all comes down to the big tiebreaker, to which, as you know, you may not answer, nobody knows. Yeah, so, fingers on buzzers, the whole game rests on this. For the £100,000 star prize, what would have happened if I'd said yes? Just buzz in when you know. At any point, just buzz in. You've all had a month to study the dossier of evidence I sent you. No? None of you? Any idea at all? Okay, I'm prepared to simplify it. For £100,000, just tell me, should I have said yes? That's all I want to know.
Yes?
No guessing!
Excuse me, sir. Is this seat in this compartment of this train that we are on taken?
No.
Oh, thank you. Oh, my. It's Mr. Elwood, isn't it?
Why, yes, I'm sorry. Have we met?
Oh, goodness me, no. I'm a complete stranger to you, I'm afraid, on this train. I couldn't mistake you. You see, I'm a huge Tiddlywinks enthusiast.
Oh, really? You follow my career?
Oh, but of course. Nicholas Elwood, the youngest Grand Slam Tiddlywink champion ever to have come out of the Maryland Tiddlywink Academy. I'm a huge fan, I assure you.
Well, thank you very much.
I know all about you. Your signature monogrammed winks, your unorthodox left-handed spin, your troubles with your wife.
What?
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hit a nerve, but, you know, it's common knowledge she disapproves of how much practice you put in, how she's always insisting you stop and give her a hand with the vacuum cleaning.
How do you know that?
Oh, I must have read it somewhere, but it's true, isn't it?
Well, yes, all right, it's true, but I don't see how...
How a stranger comes to know of it here on this train.
Good evening. Anything off the trolley? Hot drinks? Cold drinks? Sandwiches? Mini cheddars?
Thank you, we're fine.
Suit yourself.
Is, You see, I sympathize, Nicholas, really, I do. It's so annoying to have someone constantly nagging at you. I mean, take my mother, for instance.
I don't want to hear about your mother.
You see, I have the most darling kitty cat. So affectionate and clean, she's good as God about using her tray. But that's not enough for my mother.
I'm not interested.
Oh, she's a holy terror. Nag, nag, nag. Leonard, that filthy animal, that tray of hers is stinking out the house. So you see, Nicholas, I really do sympathize. We both have our problems. Your wife, my mother. Say, maybe we could do each other some good. Help each other out, you know what I'm saying?
No, I do not.
Oh, you're an intelligent man, Nicholas. Do I have to spell it out? Here we are, perfect strangers. No one knows we've met.
On this train?
Exactly, on this train that we're on. Why shouldn't we, well, solve each other's problems?
What exactly are you suggesting?
You know what I'm suggesting, Nicholas. I'll come and do your vacuuming if you'll come and change my cat's litter tray. Crisscross!
Oh, right, I thought...
What?
Nothing. So, what... You're saying we should do each other's chores.
Of course, and no one will be any the wiser.
Where do you live?
Why, Albuquerque, of course. Can't you tell from my accent?
That's 500 miles from me. You want me to do a 1,000-mile round trip to change your cat's tray?
While I'm doing your vacuuming, Nicholas, don't forget that. Crisscross.
That's crazy. I don't like changing litter trays any more than you do.
Oh, details, Nicholas, details. Crisscross.
Stop saying crisscross. It doesn't make it any more sensible just because you keep saying crisscross.
Yes, it does, Nicholas. You know it makes sense. Crisscross.
No, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense.
Look, wouldn't it just be easier if you killed my wife and I killed your mom?
What? No!
Okay, I just...
You want to kill my mom?
Well, I...
Just because she knows about a little...
Well, you said I don't even know her! That's the point! We're strangers!
You're sick! You're a psychopath!
All right, I'm sorry!
God! 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 Yes, arrest this man! He's a psycho and he's obsessed with my mom!
Ooh.
What?
Nothing. Just had an idea.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore?
Romeo.
If faith his name so beloved of mine heart, of a sudden seems most foreign to my ear.
Romeo. Romeo.
Marry, the word is passing strange. Romeo.
Romeo. Good morrow, I am Romeo. Welcome thou art, friend Romeo. I prithee, Romeo, the salt to pass. Come in, Romeo, thy tea is on the table. Romeo. Romeo. Oh, the fever passes. Wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Well, as you've asked me for a goose story, I do have one rather curious tale you may find diverting. It's not precisely a ghost story. There's certainly no actual ghosts in it. So thinking about it, it's not really what you're after, is it? Hang on, I've got another one. This one's got loads of ghosts in it. I don't know why I didn't think of this one first. There were three of us staying at the lodge that cold January night. Four if you count the housekeeper. Five if you count me. Two, if you only count me and one of the others. Mansard, Woburn and myself had spent an invigorating day eagling on the moor. Eagling is a sport of my own invention, in which I, wearing a stout pair of boots with powerful springs built into the heel, am pulled down by my companions and then released, allowing me to soar into the sky and snatch eagles out of the air. We returned home exhausted but jubilant, having equaled our best ever day's bag of no eagles. That evening, we sat up late swapping yarns, and Mansard entertained Woburn and me with his animal impressions, which made us roar, and also made him roar. As the clock struck midnight, I excused myself to see a man about a wee. As I was returning, down the long passage to the smoking room, past the living room, the sitting room, the drawing room, there suddenly rang out a piercing scream. Unremarkable in itself, but it came not from the screaming parlour, but the kitchen. At once I sprang to the door. I was still wearing my eagling boots. And flung it open. There stood one of the servants' children, a mere slip of a girl, no more than 10 years of age, and no less than 10 years of age. She was 10.
Oh, sir, an awful face, a terrible, hideous face.
I stepped forward to clip around the ear, but she dodged me.
No, sir, even before you came in,
she cried.
There, at the window. window.
I turned and saw it. What I had taken at first glance to be merely a paper bag blown up against the window pane was revealed at second glance to be a hideous, ghastly face locked in a rictus of pain. Although, on third glance, to be, after all, a paper bag blown up against the window. Nothing to fear, said I. It's just old Percy Paper Bag playing his old... Oh, for the little girl had disappeared. As softly and silently as if she had been on roller skates. Just then the housekeeper bustled in. Hello there, I cried. I'm afraid the young lady took a bit of a scare.
Young lady, sir?
The little girl, is she your daughter?
Why, sir, I durstn't know what you've been a-talking of.
Durstn't you?
I'm diddled if I durst. There ain't been a little maid down away here's a porch for nigh on 20 year. There were a little maid, sir, but she died. She died. She died! Will that be all, sir?
Yes, thank you. Baffled, I made my way back to the smoking room where Mansard sat in one of the wing-back chairs practicing his whinny. I say, Mansard, your housekeeper's rather a queer fish, isn't she? What can you tell me of her? Mansard let out a short bark of amusement, then, from force of habit, a longer bark, and then basically just woofed for a while. I turned to the window while he recovered.
Mrs. Woolm, you mean? Why, all I know of her is that she was caught in that terrible fire 30 years ago.
But I turned back from the window and beheld nothing but an empty chair. Just then Woburn re-entered. Woburn, what the devil's become of Mansard?
Woburn looked at me curiously.
Mansard? Why, Mansard died in a murdering accident. 40 years ago.
No, he didn't. He's been doing animal impressions for us all evening. And we went eagling with him. And we live with him. And he's only 37.
Oh, that Mansard. I thought you meant his grandfather. After all, our Mansard is sitting right there.
Hello.
Said Mansard.
I did like to say, but you were looking at the wrong chair. I say, Finnamore, you're looking a little cheap. Shall I ring for Mrs. Woolm to bring us tea?
But you said Mrs. Woolm was caught in a terrible fire 30 years ago.
Well, so she was. A really terrible fire. Betty even singed her petticoat. Never seen such a pathetic fire.
And I suppose you, Mrs. Woolm, for that worthy woman who had just rejoined us with the tea, I suppose you will tell me when you said the child died, you meant she died, her hair, her sundress, metaphorically but not actually of embarrassment.
Oh, no, sir. I meant every word I did do say, but then I am mad.
I can confirm that.
Called out the little girl as she roller skated past the door. So where then, after all, was the ghost in my little tale? For it wasn't Mansard, nor Woburn, nor yet Mrs. Woolm, nor the little girl, not even the face at the window pane. And the only other person in my story is I myself. And obviously it isn't me. Do you know what? I don't think there's any ghosts in this story either. I don't think I know any ghost stories. Someone else go.
John Finnamore's souvenir programme was written by and starred John Finnamore, with Margaret Caborn-Smith, Simon Kane, Laurie Lewin and Carrie Quinlan. The producer was Ed Morrish. If you are blind or partially sighted, this programme is already fine.